Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. Today, we are traveling to 1985 to discuss what some consider to be Akira Kurosawa's last cinematic masterpiece, Ron.
For people who are not familiar with the movie, I'll give a brief rundown. After 50 years of building and consolidating his empire, the great Lord Hidetoro decides to abdicate and divide his domain amongst his three sons. Toro, the oldest, will rule. Yuro, his second son, and Saburo will take command of the second and third castles, but are expected to obey and support their older brother. Saburo defies the pledge of obedience and is banished. Toro, with prodding from his wife, defies his father's wishes and sets out to take control of the whole empire, setting in motion disastrous consequences.
So, Dad, why did you pick this film?
Well, there's a couple of reasons why I picked the film. And the first one is that we were discussing Shakespeare when we were setting up this season. And I thought this would be a good film to watch because it's not traditional Shakespeare. It's inspired by Shakespeare. But it's also inspired by other things from Japanese culture. So it's a really good film if we're going to have that conversation about Shakespeare adaptations to really kind of dive into. Two, I think it's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen. It's amazingly shot. The colors, the way that they use weather throughout the film, there's just some amazing things in that film. So I thought, okay, let's discuss it because I don't think you've seen it. And it's also one of those films that when I was going through school, we were discussing films with, you know, friends and stuff, was deeply divided. There was like people who loved it and really enjoyed it for the cinematic experience it was. And there's others who thought it was slow and old-fashioned. And so I wanted to see what your take was on it. So I wanted to share it with you and see that. So those are the three main reasons why I put this in this first season. It's a really hefty thing to talk about. This film is considered a masterpiece in a lot of people's viewpoint. And I don't know if you and I are going to be able to do it justice talking about how important this film is. So I really just want to focus on this talk on how we perceived it, how we enjoyed it, how it tied into our perceptions and discussions about Shakespeare.
So this movie was inspired by William Shakespeare's King Lear, the tragedy of King Lear. And one of the things that I noticed real right off the bat when we were watching the movie is that they changed the focus from three daughters to three sons, which I thought was very interesting, especially since they kept strong-willed women throughout this movie.
So there's a couple things here. When Kurosawa was coming up with the idea for this film, he was not inspired by King Lear first. He was actually inspired by a old Japanese tale of a warlord. He's a real person, and there's a story tied to him which people argue whether or not is true or not. But when he's old and he's about to give away his kingdom to one of his sons, he went to the other two. He had them all in the same room. The other two sons were there, and he said, "I'm giving the kingdom to the son, but I want you two to support him." And he gave them each an arrow, and he told them to break it. And they all broke it very easily. Then he handed them three arrows. He said, "Break the three arrows." And they went to break them, and they couldn't break them. And he said, "See, if you work together, you cannot be broken. And if you work separately, you will be broken easily." The way the story goes is that they basically worked together to maintain the kingdom that he had created. Kurosawa was like, "Wait a minute. If you know anything about Japanese history, it doesn't happen that way very often. So what if the sons were not good, were selfish, and wanted their own power? How would it take?" So he started writing the screenplay that way from that perspective. Later on, he looks at King Lear and sees the how there are parallel stories that he was working on, and he brought King Lear in as a guide. So that's why there's the three sons versus the three daughters, because that's rooted in the Japanese story.
I thought it was very interesting seeing that even though that this movie wasn't necessarily originally a King Lear remake, I think it was really interesting to see that throughout this movie there are references and Easter eggs, if you will, about King Lear and their dialogue and their actions and some scenes that were happening and some characters. So I thought that was very interesting.
Even though he combined certain characters or took characters out or added a character here or there, he really is inspired by King Lear. And he admitted when he was making the film, he didn't know exactly when his story ended and King Lear came in, but it was definitely inspired by King Lear. That being said, he really melded it with his story, and it, even though it's a guide and even though there's characters that are definitely from the play or represent different people from the play, he definitely created it out of the Japanese culture that he was talking about.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. Throughout the first act and part of the second act, I kept on thinking in my head, who's going to get their eyes plucked out? Who's going to get their eyes plucked out? Because that's a major plot point in yes. King Lear. And when it turns out that it's Sui...
No, that's the sister. I don't remember the character's name, but anyway, it's her brother, and it turns out he was the one that had the eyes, but it was actually done years before.
Years before, and I think that was a very interesting way to introduce that idea, especially since they find him in a hut in the dark during, quote-unquote, a storm, because that's how they re-meet Gloucester, who in the play gets his eyes plucked out. So it's a very fun, and if you like King Lear like I do, and I was King Lear in a production and things like that and know the play very well, it's really fun to watch this movie and being like, oh, he was obviously inspired by this. Oh, he's obviously inspired by this. But then if you're also not a Shakespeare nerd, it's doesn't take away from the story, because there's no, like, hey, everybody, this is a Shakespeare movie, blah, 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 and big lights. It's just like a nice adaptation of a sad, tragic story.
Yeah, and there's also the things where he has molded it to Japanese history and culture. So if you watch a lot of Japanese films, you'll see references to those in the film. I think the main difference for me is that in King Lear is generally a good person. And, well, no, generally meaning he's a king, so he's made decisions in the past that aren't good or affect people. But he's not talked about as if he's this warlord who has conquered everything. But he's considered more foolish than anything. And he makes these foolish choices. He listens to the wrong people. In this movie, the Great Lord is a warlord who has spent since he was 17. In fact, he brags about it at the beginning, consolidating his power. He's now in his early 70s, so it's over 50 years of war, of using conspiracy and conflict to get what he wants. When he took over certain castles and the clans and took out different groups, like the blind character, he actually ordered the blind character to be blinded years before. This was him coming back and seeing what he had done. The wife of his son, he had, when he took over the main castle, her family was in charge of, he had killed her family and married her off to his first son. So she has revenge in her mind. And she's actively plotting against him to get control, to take down his family. That's her whole point.
And that character is very interesting too, because you can see, though King Lear, some plot lines and some characters were discarded because it doesn't fit the movie that he was making, you could definitely see a parallel between her and Edmund, who is an illegitimate son who's out for revenge against his father, the Earl of Gloucester, and who eventually, you know, pits the sisters against each other, eventually gets enough power to kill people, but not enough power to actually, like, rule and things like that. And you can definitely see that within her, where she's a very scheming and she's, like, four steps ahead of everybody and understands ultimately it leads to her downfall, just like everybody in this movie. But it's a very interesting way to introduce a character that in the Renaissance would have been totally understandable. Oh, you're an illegitimate son. Your father didn't care for you. You know, you're evil for evil's sake, which is an excuse and that would have been totally fine. But in the 80s, that wouldn't have made sense. And so it was really interesting how Kurosawa formed that character into medieval Japanese culture.
His big knock against Shakespeare was he felt the characters didn't have history. They only had the history of what's inside that play. And so he was trying to give all the characters history. So when you saw them act out, you understood their motivations. You may not agree with them, but you understood them. That was one of his things that he was constantly working on. I mean, this movie took him 10 years to make. And so there's a lot of changes he made. He went like from that original idea to being inspired by King Lear.
You mentioned before that some people, when you first experienced this film, thought it was a little slow and old-fashioned. And Shakespeare is also given that moniker of slow and old-fashioned. So as a person who enjoyed this movie, did you think that Kurosawa gave enough life to the characters, to the story?
I think one of the things that's kind of interesting is by this time in his career, Kurosawa was considered old and old-fashioned in the Japanese filmmaking community. In fact, by 65, they were saying that he was passé, that he wasn't active, he wasn't part of the new vanguard of Japanese film. And you can see that because it's harder and harder for him to get financing for his films. His film production really slows down. Like between 1945 and 1965, he makes an average of one film a year, about 20 films. 1965, Redbeard comes out. And then after that, between 1965 and 1985, he makes four films. There's the famous story of him coming to America to help make Tora, Tora, Tora. He ends up getting fired off of that because his creative style does not work well with American filmmaking style. He's very particular and very exacting, and he with no problem redoing things and making it perfect. And of course, when you're making this big budget war film for a studio, they want it done on time and done under budget. So that was one of that was a kind of a famous story in there too. So in 73 to 75 is when he comes up with the story. He starts to ask the questions about what if these sons were bad. He starts to write out the story. So in 1980, he makes Kegamusha, which he actually needs the help of, I think it's George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola, who end up helping him get funding to finish the film. And of course, the American studio that helps him at that point gets distribution rights. He calls that his practice run for Ron. This whole time he's painting pictures and doing production on it, and his eyesight is failing him. So he uses these pictures that he paints as like his storyboard. And if you actually look at, they released the screenplay with his pictures. If you actually look at it, those pictures there, you can see literally those shots in the film.
I really like the one where where it's like one for one, and you can see the scene in the movie and in the painting of him wearing the grass hat.
Yes.
I don't know why, but I really like that picture. Really like called out to me.
Because he couldn't see, because his eyesight was failing him. He would show his cameraman the paintings. He had sketches because he'd get close to the paper and sketch it out. And they were able to like do a storyboard and frame the shots and do what he wanted. But as far as bringing life to the story of King Lear, yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact if you see how he prepared for the film, he would do these paintings of the scenes that he wanted And if you look at them, they're really vibrant and they're full of energy, and they use color really well. And this is, he's more known for using black and white film. And this is like, I think only like his fourth or fifth color film. And he definitely is using color to bring this vibrant story. It's just like really amazingly shot because of his use of color. And I think that's one of the ways that he brings life. Even though it took 10 years to make this film, he didn't like put it away and like not work on it. He kept on bringing it back out, working on it. So you can definitely see the planning and the way that he structures this film, those 10 years spent. So you're the resident Shakespeare nerd for our family. We all like Shakespeare. We all are familiar with it, but you're the one that's really gone in studying it, and you're probably going to keep studying it for the rest of your life. Do you feel this film was a good representation of a story that inspired by Shakespeare?
So I do think that this is a really good representation of what Shakespeare can be. A lot of people get sidetracked with the language and they say, well, it's Old English, which is also not true. It's Old English. I can't understand it. I won't ever understand it. It's, you know, it's only relatable to a certain person, and usually that person has some elitism attached to them. And I think movies like this, where it's not a direct translation or a direct, you know, they just popped open a script from William Shakespeare and just plopped a camera in front and just started spouting Shakespeare. I think these types of movies show that Shakespeare is super universal. The stories, you can see the stories that he used as references, that he was attached to throughout different cultures. I think movies like Ron, where somebody from a different culture outside of what we would consider a Shakespeare land, you know, took Shakespeare, took what Shakespeare meant to him, and morphed it into something beautiful. I think this movie is a really good adaptation. And I was joking with you, like, if I was a teacher, one of my teachers in high school, and King Lear came up, and, you know, they would always give us like a list of movies that you should watch on your own time, and I would put Ron in that category of King Lear movies that somebody should watch, because it also puts the story into a different time period, so people aren't so focused on, well, he's an illegitimate son. I can't relate to that because that's not a thing that happens now. Or, why are they murdering each other for power? I don't understand that because we don't have kings and queens anymore like they did back in the day. And I think when we take Shakespeare out of the context of the Renaissance and out of Shakespeare's time period, it create something beautiful. And I really enjoyed this movie as a Shakespeare reference, as a Shakespeare guide, or just as a introduction to Japanese film. I think when we separate ourselves from the title of Shakespeare, it's, you know, that whole like, oh my God, he's the greatest writer ever, I have to like him or not. When we separate that panic from the material, a lot of beautiful things come out of it, which is one of the reasons why I like this movie. I think it also allows some people watching it to interpret the story differently and to add their own canon to Shakespeare and their own thought process, and maybe even go like even start thinking about Shakespeare outside of just the words. So I think this is a really great movie, and I would definitely add it to my Shakespeare movies I should watch list.
Yeah. I like it too for Kurosawa. When he wrote the screenplay, he definitely brought in the elements of King Lear. And then he has characters even ask those questions. Like, there's certain characters that ask certain questions in the play, and it may not be the direct character that says that question or says that line in the movie, or the line that's inspired by that in the movie. But there's also a character that usually comes back with a rebuttal. And I thought that was really cool. Like, the most famous one is at the end when the jester character basically says, we're being crushed, but like ants by the gods, and which is a direct reference to King Lear when the jester in King Lear says, we're like boys squishing flies. The gods are like boys squishing flies, and we're just here at their amusement. Kurosawa takes it one step further and goes, no, he has another character respond, no, the gods aren't laughing. They're crying because they were watching us kill each other for years and years. So he's actually responding to Shakespeare, which I found it really fun. One of the things, too, that I wanted to ask you about was, in this movie, weather is used as almost a character throughout the film. It's such an important part of the setting. How did you like Akira Kurosawa's interpretation and using weather through the film?
I think the motif of weather throughout the film allows a lot of people to understand the themes of King Lear as well, because storm imagery and lightning imagery are throughout the text in King Lear. And I think when we see something visually, we'll understand it better. I also think it's a very interesting filmmaking technique to add visual representations of someone's madness, i.e. the sun is bright and it's sunny the first time we see these characters, and then then the last scene where the great lord is dead is like dark and foggy, and you can barely see a lot of people and things like that, overcast and things like that. So I think it's really interesting. It's like the same thing of like the fun fact of like seeing a villain go from wearing white robes to black robes. It's very interesting to have visual representations because it allows people to follow the story better. Also adds a pretty cool element. Yeah, so I just think with the storm imagery, especially since it's like an homage to William Shakespeare's writing and his references throughout the play, I also thought it was very interesting, even though Kurosawa does have this storm imagery and this cloud imagery and this weather imagery throughout this whole movie, he doesn't have a storm scene like King Lear does. King Lear, one of the most famous scenes in King Lear is when Lear is half mad, yelling at the sky, it's thundering, it's raining, and he's like blaming God, he's blaming his daughters, he's pretending like he's in a court and things like that. So like there's this most famous scene that doesn't really happen in this adaptation of King Lear. And I think it's a very interesting idea because he replaces it, well, at least in my opinion, replaces this outwardly aggression and outward madness with a very internal scene, a very quiet scene where the great lord is sitting in a castle burning. The castle is burning. People are shooting it from his two older sons. His two older son armies are shooting arrows and flaming arrows and muskets into this. None of them are hitting him, and he's just sitting there. And the camera just focuses on his face, and I thought that was a very interesting way to replace this storm scene and to show his break from reality.
Yeah, because after that scene, he ends up stumbling out of the castle. He's obviously mad. The armies don't know what to do with him. They let him pass and go off into the wilds. And there is a storm he's walking through, but it's not like this big, loud, thunderous storm. And he's not yelling at the sky, like you said. So, yeah, it was very interesting, too. This film, for me, Ron, was more about the great lord's character coming to terms with the world that he had created. And King Lear has that too. He doesn't see himself the same way that everybody else sees him. So he has that reckoning, where this is a much deeper reckoning. This is a guy who used, like we said earlier, conflict and conspiracy and murder and mayhem to get power. And it was kind of, and then he's almost shocked that it's used against him when he decides to step aside. And that chink in his armor that kind of like shows that he's not as strong as he used to be. Everybody at that point starts flooding in to try to take him out. And I think that reckoning, and when he's sitting there in the castle, and the two armies are surrounding the castle, and they're killing his men that are left, and they're taking over the castle, and he's just sitting there and he's focusing and he's seeing what he has created, and it's aimed back at him. That's a very, yeah, very, very powerful scene. One of the aspects too, where you see the color aspect of how beautiful this film is, like the older son's army is a yellow, because his color is yellow. His middle son is red, and they're both, so you have these two armies that are yellow and red fighting around this castle that's burning. So you have this whole imagery of war and yellow red flames being echoed by the actual armies that are fighting, and it's really a magnificent scene.
Shakespeare is such a poetic author that I think it's very appropriate that Kurosawa added visual poetry to an adaptation.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that when we were talking about Shakespeare in film, this is what I really like about people who do Shakespeare in film and push it forward. They're not so worried about maintaining the language.
Or the status quo, because there's a lot of things that people do that are like, we can't do this because it's not proper. I really enjoyed that he just was like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And by this time, though, he's also 70 years old, and I really, 75, I think, actually, when he made this film. And I think he's at this point going, I'm going to make the film I'm going to make, and nobody's going to tell me differently. And I think the thing, too, that you said, visual poetry, he's very good, even black and white or color, he's very good at setting up these shots, and they work together. They go into the next shot. One thing, too, that's a little bit different about this film, because it does have battle scenes, and it does have court intrigue, but if you notice, by this time in filmmaking, the camera is constantly moving into the battle, constantly moving with the battle, constantly moving with the characters. And in this, he had a lot more locked down shots. There's still shots where things move, and there's still some shots where there's like pans and things like that, but a lot of things are locked down, and a lot of things aren't close-ups. There's not a lot of close-ups. So when they actually are close-ups, they're more powerful. And you also can see the other characters' reactions to the character, but he lets the action come into the scene. So at certain points, so you're seeing setups of this is how the character thinks the scene's going to go, and then the action comes in, and the scene completely changes by the midpoint, by the actions of the other characters. One of the reasons why it looks so painterly and poetic is because of the way he's setting up scenes.
I've discussed one of my favorite parts of the movie, which is the replacement storm scene. I also really enjoy visual poetry that happens throughout this movie. What is your favorite parts of this movie?
Well, there's things that this film was not an easy shoot for him. This film had some problems and some tragedies. His wife died halfway through filming. He took a day off to mourn her, and then went back to work. And then his longtime collaborator, who was his sound designer, also collapsed on set towards the end and ended up passing away. So it was a very tough movie for him to make. And so for me, the thing that always, when I remember that, I always think about how he's able, the film Ron translates to chaos. At the beginning, you have this very well-ordered group with the leader, the sons, the allies. And by the end, it has fallen all into chaos. A lot of people have died. And you don't know, there actually isn't anybody on the throne at the end. Nobody is leading. There is no clear-cut leader at the end. When you're working on films and things like that, I do feel that there's this aspect in that film of the main character, is he really believes it's him. like is stand-in for Akira Kurosawa. I've created all this stuff, and now I'm going to be walking away here pretty soon. And what does it mean? Who's replacing this? And people have argued, well, the son's fighting, so that represents different actors who no longer worked with him, different people who would no longer work with him. Some people and the people who stood by him are represented by other characters and stuff like that. That goes a little bit too deep for me because I don't really know that much about his working relationships. But I do think that it's very interesting as a person towards the end of their career, towards the end of their life, having those questions. What have I created? What have I done? And that's what this character is doing through the entire movie. And he doesn't necessarily like what he's created or what he's done. And so he has to come to reckoning with that. I don't know if that's how Akira Kurosawa felt. But there's definitely that aspect of questioning what you've done with your life and whether or not you accept it or not. And that makes it a much more personal film. This film could be very beautiful, could be very grand and epic like it is. And without that personal part thrown in there, I think it would have been cold. But I think with that personal touch, it really roots it, grounds it, and makes it a much more human film than it could have been.
So this play, King Lear, was believed to have been performed for the first time around 1606, which is like 10 years before Shakespeare has died. And you can see towards the end of his writing career, a lot of his plays have to do with mortality and growing old. And I think one of the plays that showcases this the most is King Lear. So it's very poignant when a filmmaker 400 years later uses the same material to work through his emotions about getting older and what it means to leave the world that he's created behind. And so it's, you know, and one of the things that I love about Shakespeare is that, you know, Shakespeare, a lot of his stuff was taken from stories about real life. So art imitates real life, but also real life imitates art, and I think that's really interesting.
One of the things that I wanted to get back to, we mentioned earlier, was the way the film was designed. Now, we talked about a little bit that he was losing his eyesight, and so he had to paint these pictures that became part of his storyboards that really talked about the color that he was using, how the film was very colorful and had a lot of primary colors. Now, we know in this world, primary colors weren't that common, and you wouldn't have a whole army wearing one color. They'd have banners, but not all red banners or all yellow banners or all white or all blue. So that's one of the things that he's using that to paint this world. For people who are looking at this for historical accuracy, I think it's kind of the wrong way to look at this film. This film was really about emotions, feelings, but it's all emotionally based. And so the world he's painting literally with the camera has bold colors, bold strokes. Nature is always green in this film, unless it's been fouled by man. Because you'll see all the land around the castles being bare, and then during the battle scenes that they're bare, it's muddy, it's smoking. It gives this really eerie rolling fog on the ground, and that's because Kurosawa was very interested in the imagery of nuclear war. So if you look at the battle scenes and how desolate they are and how things are all gray and tore up, and he's using that imagery when he's building the battle scenes around the castles. Purposely takes away the sounds of battle and puts the score of the music first to show the emotional aspect of the people who are dying versus the actual sounds of battle. Later on, the battle is more naturalistic, but even that battle has interesting sound design. So he really designs, if you notice they're out in the plains, you can hear the insects really loud versus just the wind. It's like, and it's also to be timing with the great lord's mental breakdown, like insects gnawing at his brain type things. So it's like he definitely designed everything in this film. I know that that's expected of a Kurosawa film, that there's a very specific way he wants things done, but he did such grand things, like when the king is leaving the castle and it's burning behind him. He was literally burning that castle set, and there was one shot. If the king had tripped and fell, they weren't coming back to refilm it. So he made big, grandiose set pieces. There was risks in the filmmaking. You could feel it. And I think that led to why the film feels so grand.
As we've mentioned before, not Kurosawa's first Shakespeare-inspired film. He also did Throne of Blood, which he's really famous for, along with Bad Sleep Well, which I have actually never heard of until we did some research for this movie.
Well, this is the thing. So Throne of Blood, which is his Macbeth film.
Mankers.
Yep.
Scottish play.
Scottish play. Is pretty much his version of Macbeth. Everybody agrees that it's, of all his adaptations, it's the one that's the most similar to the play and has the most influence from Shakespeare. The second one that they talk about is Ron being King Lear. The Bad Sleep Well is now being added into that list. It wasn't originally added in that list, but there's so many parallels with Hamlet that people say that he was inspired by Hamlet. And so that's being thrown into the list now. I think it's the one that people consider the least influenced by the play.
I just really wanted to add, when we were reading about this and stuff, I thought it was very interesting. In my brain, I always call these three plays, Macbeth, Hamlet, and King Lear, the royal tragedies. Because, you know, everything in Shakespeare has to have, like, boxes they fill into. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very interesting that the top, like, the big three tragedies, in my opinion, he did, goes to show, you know, that tragedy is universal. And
well, it can be at least adapted to. What you're talking about and what be considered. There's a really good essay called Hamlet in the Bush that I think people should read. And it's basically an anthropologist in Africa telling when this person is studying another culture, they're telling them all the stories of their culture. And then at the end, they said, okay, tell us a story from your culture. And this anthropologist was going, okay, I'm going to impress them with Hamlet. And right off the bat, the culture was like, well, of course the uncle is going to marry the wife. That's what you're supposed to do. And of course, and they basically, the other group of people came to the conclusion that Hamlet was just a spoiled brat and needed to be taught a lesson. And it's a very interesting take. And that could be seriously a legitimate interpretation of that play. I mean, there's a lot of other things that are going on in that play that say, because you're following Hamlet's point of view, but you could do a different point of view on that play, just like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, and do a different perspective and show that Hamlet isn't all that cool.
So we did mention Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, and to wrap up this two-part episode of The Tempest, which is more a more traditional adaptation of William Shakespeare's works, and Ron, which is a little bit more modern and a little bit more unique interpretation of Shakespeare. Are there any other Shakespeare adaptations or Shakespeare inspired films that you really like?
So one of the movies that really popped into my head since last week because we talked about The Tempest was Forbidden Planet, which is a science fiction movie came out in 1956. It basically is a science fiction version of The Tempest. A scientist is on a planet with Robbie the robot and his daughter, and a spaceship lands and it moves forward from that. So that's one of my favorite Shakespeare adaptations into a film. Another thing I think people should watch Forbidden Planet, and it might show up here on our season 2, because I don't think you've seen it.
No, I have not.
But if you really want to see a lot of a lot of staples of American science fiction from the 60s, 70s, and 80s come from Forbidden Planet. And there's like callbacks and things like that.
You know, you could always make an argument that like 10 Things I Hate About You and She's the Man did a wonderful job of interpreting Shakespeare into a modern day high school setting.
Yeah.
Which I think is really good. I really enjoyed 10 Things I Hate About You just as a romantic comedy, let alone a really good adaptation of a problematic play, which is an adaptation of Taming of the Shrew, which is not necessarily the most friendly towards women.
No, I think they've actually fixed some of the issues in that play.
I think if you're going for something a little bit more traditional, I think Ethan Hawke's Hamlet is really good. It's technically a modern day Hamlet, but the to be or not to be speech takes a place in Blockbuster, so take that as you will.
So if I had to go with a straight film adaptation of a play, I like Kenneth Branagh's adaptation of Hamlet and of Henry V. I do not like any of
it's his, on my list too.
I don't like any of his other adaptations.
You don't like Much Ado About Nothing? How dare you?
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot Much Ado About Nothing. But,
everything else, yeah.
Just, I was thinking of Love, Labor's Lost and
As You Like It was a little weird.
As You Like It. As You Like It felt to me like he had an idea. He didn't have enough budget, but he went with the idea anyway. So I really didn't.
Well, look at that. Kenneth Branagh's As You Like It is
set in Japan.
It's set in Japan and set in a imperial Japan.
I don't know. It didn't click with me.
It didn't click with me either. We turned it off halfway through, and then we were like, maybe we should.
I've never gone back to it.
Yeah. Well, I also think movies that that take the language of Shakespeare and move it around is also very interesting. One movie that does that is the 2015 Macbeth, starring Michael Fassbender. Though it's technically a traditional adaptation in the sense of like script, William Shakespeare's script in front of a camera, they do take some language away. They cut some of the language out. They give new language to different people. They add some visual representations of things that are going on. They add a little bit extra. There's like this prologue, like for a better term, that happens where you see that they both had a child and the child died. And so that adds a little bit more sympathy to the two characters, and it adds a different reading to Shakespeare, which I think is very interesting as well.
So another film that I really enjoy that's inspired by Shakespeare is Chimes at Midnight, done by Orson Welles, where he took the character of Falstaff and all the different references of him in the plays and built a movie around Falstaff, which is very interesting because you get to see the different versions of Falstaff. It's not Orson Welles' best film. I just really enjoyed watching it because of all the references. And it was very interesting to see Orson Welles at this time had gotten a little heavy, really felt like he embodied the role of Falstaff. So I really like that one. The King kind of did something very similar on Netflix. Was it last year, 2 years ago?
I think it, yeah.
Where they told Henry V differently with different aspects, but definitely heavily inspired by Shakespeare's play. Would you recommend this film to people to watch?
I would recommend this movie to some people. I know that this movie might be considered long to some people, and it might not be a movie that you gel with or a movie that you really want to watch, but I really enjoyed it. I think it was really good. I will probably be watching it again later on in my life.
I think it's very interesting for me because I was thinking about people talking about how slow this film is back when it came out and when I was watching it in film school. And when we were discussing it, I said that there are some people that felt it was old fashioned and slow and some people who really like got into it. And then I was thinking about all these miniseries, how slow and deliberately they're paced. And I'm thinking, why wouldn't people like this film? It's deliberately paced. I wouldn't call it slow, but it's definitely deliberately paced. And you could almost throw up title cards. There's two spots in the middle that you can almost break it up into three different episodes and throw up title cards, and people would be like, okay, I'm gonna watch the next one. I don't know why there's that disconnect with, it's a long movie, I don't want to watch it, but I'll watch 18 hours of the same series. So I would recommend this to people who, flatly, without really many caveats, I would just tell them it's a very deliberately paced film, so get ready for it, but it goes pretty quickly, and there's not a sagging part in the film. It doesn't get slow at any point. It's always moving along.
And everything you see on camera is deliberate. There's nothing that's just added there to make it longer. Everything makes sense on screen.
Yes. And I think that's the thing that why I would recommend this to most people. All right. So I think that's pretty much it for this week. We discussed Ron, which is one of my favorite films. There are some really great books out there. The one that I would recommend is Akira Kurosawa's Something Like an Autobiography, which is him actually talking about his own films, which I remember reading and really enjoying. There's also some documentaries out there that I would recommend watching.
And if you are like me and want to know a little bit more about Shakespeare and King Lear, I would definitely recommend A Year of Lear. It's super interesting. It goes through the year of William Shakespeare's life and talks about the play. It's really good.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you guys for listening. If you like this episode and want to contact us, you can follow us on Instagram at TML, A Journey Through Cinema, or on Facebook under The Movie Log. If you have a suggestion for a movie that we should watch, please email us at tmlajourneythroughcinema@gmail.com or post on our Facebook wall. These are the two sources that we focus on most.
Have a great day.
Have a great day. Thank you.